This is January 4th, 2008. And
2009.
You got me. All right. season of resolutions, I'm going to read from an article about free will and examine to what extent we have free will, and if whatever we have, what it really means. This is from the New York Times. It was actually 2 years ago, but it doesn't matter. It's by Dennis Overby, and the title of it is Free Will. Now you have it, now you don't. He starts off with a little account of struggling at a restaurant, struggling with whether to order for dessert one of those molten chocolate cakes, he says. And I was suddenly being dragged into a vortex, swirling helplessly toward caloric doom, sucked toward the edge of a black chocolate hole. Visions of my father's heart attack danced before my glazed eyes. My wife, Nancy, had a resigned look on her face. And then he goes on, having just lived through another New Year's Eve, many of you have just resolved to be better, wiser, stronger, and richer in the coming months and years. After all, we're free humans, not slaves, robots, or animals doomed to repeat the same boring mistakes over and over again. As William James wrote in 1890, the whole sting and excitement of life comes from, quote, our sense that in it, things are really being decided from one moment to another, and that it is not the dull rattling off of a chain that was forged innumerable ages ago. And then the author says, get over it, Dr. James. Go get yourself fitted for a new chainmail vest. A bevy of experiments in recent years suggest that the conscious mind is like a monkey riding a tiger of subconscious decisions and actions in progress, frantically making up stories about being in control. As a result, physicists, neuroscientists, and computer scientists have joined the heirs of Plato and Aristotle in arguing about what free will is, whether we have it, and if not, why we ever thought we did in the first place. And then he quotes a Michael Silberstein, science philosopher. Is it an illusion? That's the question. Another question, he added, is whether talking about this in public will fan the culture wars. If people freak at evolution and so forth, he wrote in an email message, how much more will they freak if scientists and philosophers tell them they are nothing more than sophisticated meat machines? And is that conclusion now clearly warranted, or is it premature? Daniel Dennett, a philosopher and cognitive scientist at Tufts University, who has written extensively about free will, said that when we consider whether free will is an illusion or reality, we are looking into an abyss. What seems to confront us is a plunge into nihilism and despair. We'll hear from him again later that will leave us feeling no despair. Mark Hallett, a researcher with the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, said, free will does exist, but it's a perception, not a power or a driving force. People experience free will. They have the sense they are free. A little more here, or maybe a lot more. That is hardly a new thought. The German philosopher Schopenhauer said, as Einstein paraphrased it, that a human can very well do what he wants, but cannot will what he wants. A human can very well do what he wants, but cannot will what he wants. Einstein, among others, found that a comforting idea. This knowledge of the non-freedom of the will protects me from losing my good humor and taking much too seriously myself and my fellow humans as acting and judging individuals. How comforted or depressed this makes you might depend on what you mean by free will. Of course, it's so much of this comes down to semantics. The traditional definition is called libertarian or deep free will. It holds that humans are free moral agents whose actions are not predetermined. This school of thought says that, in effect, the whole chain of cause and effect in the history of the universe stops dead in its tracks as you ponder the dessert menu. At that point, anything is possible. Whatever choice you make is unforced and could have been otherwise, but it is not random. You are responsible for any damage to your pocketbook and your arteries. That strikes many people as incoherent, said Dr. Silberstein, who noted that every physical system that has been investigated has turned out to be either deterministic or random. Both are bad news for free will, he said. So if human actions can't be caused and aren't random, he said, it must be, what, some weird magical power? Now we're getting there. But whatever that power is, call it soul or the spirit or true nature, those people have to explain how it could stand independent of the physical universe and yet reach from the immaterial world and meddle in our own jiggling brain cells that lead us to say the words molten chocolate. All right, I'm going to stop here before I read further and just comment on a few of these things. This traditional definition of free will that he cites, that holds that humans are free moral agents whose actions are not predetermined. Well, in Buddhism, we would have a problem with the word agents. And this is why. Awakening reveals the emptiness of what are called the three wheels. The three wheels are just an old way of referring to the subject, the object, and the action. So, for example, the one who is deciding the subject, that's the subject, the decision that's made, and the act of deciding. Or we could say, in the case of seeing, there's the one, the seer, there's the object seen, and there's the act of seeing. This is perception. And what awakening reveals is that there is no, in any substantial ordinary sense, there is no I. There's no agent who's doing the seeing. Nor is there an object out there. And if there's neither subject nor object, ultimately, then there can be no seeing. Of course, this makes no sense to our mind of common sense, but there we have it. When we say no subject and no object, this doesn't mean, it just means that in no absolute unchanging sense is there a self or an other. That the self and the object, the subject and the object, are more processes than objects or things. This goes to the basic Buddhist teaching, the fundamental core Buddhist experience of shunyata, or emptiness, the no-thingness of things. So we can discard the notion of a free moral agent because there is no entity, no unchanging substantial entity that we can put our finger on and say, it is, or I am. And that takes us away from this traditional notion of free will. More on that later. As for this power, or he says, both the deterministic and random explanations are both bad for free will, bad news for free will. It must be some weird magical power. Then we get into this reality, this no-thing that we refer to in Zen as the true self, the self nature, our original mind, Buddha nature, essential mind, essential self. All of these are ways of referring to that which cannot be substantiated. It can't be nailed down. And this is what makes Zen, this is the way in which Zen can be understood as a religion, because you can't offer any empirical proof of this self with a capital S, this true nature. It is through the direct experience of it, awakening to it, that we find proof of it. More on this later. He goes on, in the 1970s, Benjamin Libet, a physiologist at the University of California in San Francisco, wired up the brains of volunteers to an electroencephalogram and told the volunteers to make random motions, like pressing a button or flicking a finger, while he noted the time on a clock. Dr. Libet found that brain signals associated with these actions occurred half a second before the subject was conscious of deciding to make them. This is a very famous experiment. About 5 or 6 years ago, I did a Tay show where we mentioned this, and it just blew everyone's mind when this came out, and it was repeated. The experiment was replicated by other researchers, and scientists have been left ever since, these past, 25 years, puzzling over how this could be. Let me read that again, that brain signals associated with these actions occurred half a second before the subject was conscious of deciding to make them. And he says the order of brain activity seemed to be perception of motion and then decision rather than the other way around. You get it? So something is already in motion before we're aware of willing, of deciding. In short, he says, the conscious brain was only playing catch-up to what the unconscious brain, or we could say the non-conscious brain, was already doing. The decision to act was an illusion, the monkey making up a story about what the tiger had already done. This is referring back to this old analogy of a monkey riding, the monkey of the conscious mind riding on the tiger of this mind that is beyond the conscious deciding mind. Dr. Libet's results have been reproduced again and again over the years, along with other experiments that suggest that people can be easily fooled when it comes to assuming ownership of their actions. Patients with tics or certain diseases, like chorea, it's a nervous disorder, cannot say whether their movements are voluntary or involuntary. In some experiments, subjects have been tricked into believing they are responding to stimuli they couldn't have seen in time to respond to, or into taking credit or blame for things they couldn't have done. And then he refers to the voodoo, the so-called voodoo experiment by a psychologist at Harvard called Dan Wegner, in which two people are invited to play witch doctor. One person, the subject, puts a curse on the other by sticking pins into a doll. The second person, however, is in on the experiment and by prior arrangement with the doctors acts either obnoxious so that the pin sticker dislikes him or nice. After a while, the ostensible victim complains of a headache. In cases in which he or she was unlikable, the subject tended to claim responsibility for causing the headache. An example of the magical thinking that makes baseball fans put on their rally caps, Luann. We made it happen in a lab, Dr. Wegner said. Is a similar sort of magical thinking responsible for the experience of free will? And then he quotes this Dr. Wegner again. We see two tips of the iceberg, the thought and the action, and we draw a connection. The author says, but most of the action is going on beneath the surface. Indeed, the conscious mind is often a drag on many activities. Too much thinking can give a golfer the yips. Drivers perform better on automatic pilot. Fiction writers report writing in a kind of trance in which they simply take dictation from the voices and characters in their head. And here, the same applies to learning how to do Zen meditation. When we begin, when we first undertake this practice, we are so consciously trying to do everything right. We've got the various elements of posture that we are trying to get right. We're trying to do the same with our mental practice of the counting of the breaths. The whole thing is a struggle to do what we've been told and to get it all right. But then, as time goes on, either a shorter or longer period of time, when we settle into the posture in particular, then things start to flow on their own. We get out of the way, basically. We get the conscious mind, the deciding mind, the discriminating mind out of the way, and then things fall into place. He goes on, naturally, almost everyone has a slant on such experiments and whether or not the word illusion should be used in describing free will. Dr. Libet said his results left room for a limited version of free will in the form of veto power over what we sense ourselves doing. In effect, the unconscious brain proposes and the mind disposes. So we have the impulse. We have the impulse to whatever, smoke a cigarette, and or yell at someone for something, and that impulse originates before we're aware of it. But then, luckily, we have what this veto power, where we do have a choice as to whether to give way to that impulse, and that's why. Most of the Ten Commandments are framed in the negative. They're do not. And it's the same with the Buddhist precepts. In many versions you read of the ten precepts, there is no second part to them. They're only in the negative. I resolve not to kill. That's number one. Number two is I resolve not to take what is not given. I resolve not to misuse sexuality. We, like as our predecessors did, we have added the positive afterward. I resolve not to kill, but to cherish all life. But the more important part is that veto. I resolve not to lie. So that's a big thing. That's a big, hugely, monumentally important part of right conduct, or conducting ourselves in a way that doesn't cause unnecessary harm to our other people or ourselves, is that veto power. Dr. Dennett is one of many who have tried to redefine free will in a way that involves no escape from the materialist world while still offering enough autonomy for moral responsibility, which seems to be what everyone cares about. The belief that the traditional intuitive notion of a free will divorced from causality is inflated metaphysical nonsense, Dr. Dennett says, that reflects an outdated dualistic view of the world. Now, I'm completely with him on this. And this also would be rejected from a Buddhist understanding. Rather, Dr. Dennett argues, it is precisely our immersion in causality in the material world that frees us. Evolution, history, and culture have endowed us with feedback systems that give us the unique ability to reflect and think things over and to imagine the future. Free will and determinism can coexist. And then he puts it this way, very, very insightfully. All the varieties of free will worth having, we have. We have the power to veto our urges and then to veto our vetoes, he said. We have the power of imagination to see and imagine futures. In this regard, causality is not our enemy but our friend, giving us the ability to look ahead and plan. That's what makes us moral agents, Dr. Dennett said. You don't need a miracle to have responsibility. What sprang to mind as I read these few sentences is one of the most famous koans in Zen is number two in the Mumonkan collection, Hyakujo and a Fox. And for new people, let me just briefly tell this story. In this great Chinese Zen master, Hyakujo, would give a talk every week, say Sunday morning, and he would always notice someone in the back of the hall who would come and go with the monks. And once this mysterious person waited afterward and said, "I am not what I appear to be. I'm not really a monk. I'm a fox." Consigned to my fox existence because I used to be the abbot of this monastery and I answered a question incorrectly. Now here, for those of you who don't know koans, there's of course an element of mythology here. Don't get tangled up in how he could be a fox and look like a person. A fox is just a way is just considered it's considered a unfortunate kind of reincarnation to be a fox. He said, and he told him he'd been born, reborn 500 times as a fox. So the Hyakujo, the current abbot, says to this former abbot, "Well, what was the question you asked?" And the former abbot, now supposedly a fox, said, "Well, this was the question. does the enlightened person fall under the chain of cause and effect or not? And he said, please respond to me, tell me this, so that I may be reborn, liberated from my fox body, and become a human again. So does the enlightened person still fall under the chain of cause and effect, causality? In other words, is the enlightened person still determined? Is this, he's asking about determinism, free will or determinism. And Hyakujo said, he does not ignore the law of causation. He didn't say yes. He didn't say no. He does not ignore the law of causation. And I think this Dr. Dennett hits the nail on the head when he says, it is precisely our immersion in causality in the material world that frees us. It is by becoming one with our circumstances. Circumstances is just another word for the cause and effect, the world of causation. It is by becoming one with our circumstances that we find freedom. Or to turn it around, the more we think about, especially think about in a complaining way, the more we think about our circumstances, the more we tend to be bound by them. This came up yesterday in the workshop when we were talking about pain and how to deal with pain. Pain is a circumstance or a condition. How do you free yourself from pain? Not by thinking about it, not by sitting and feeling sorry for yourself or having any number of other millions of thoughts about the pain, strategizing about it, but becoming one with it. This is hard to believe until one has experienced it, because we're so conditioned to flee pain, mentally flee it. We're in pain, we can't move. What do? Well, our habit from the past is to try to escape it, mentally escape it, go off into some fantasy or think about something else. But that may work briefly, but it's not any real ultimate solution. The real way out is through becoming one with. And it's the same with any experience, any circumstances that we experience as aversive, as painful. Recently, I talked with a couple of different people independently who described their circumstances as a parent with kids and very busy lives, full-time jobs, and where they felt stymied by how they could manage to really do Zen practice while having such circumstances, being so busy and having so many responsibilities. Well, the Zen response is you become one with those. You just throw yourselves into them. Zen practice goes far beyond sitting. Sitting helps, absolutely. Without sitting, we would just be lost. We need to sit as much as we can, but for people, for parents and other people who are very busy, you may not be able to do a whole lot of sitting. And so what do? Well, the whole point of the sitting is to enable us to become one with our lives. That's the ultimate point, not to sit. So sitting is just the means to that end. It's also an end in itself. But at the same time, it's a method or way of becoming one with our lives and all the circumstances and changing conditions of our lives. That's the point. That's what we're doing all this for. So you sit as much as you can, which may not be a lot, and then when you're not sitting, you don't go through your life wishing you weren't a parent or you had a different job or you could get to more sesshins or whatever. You just become completely one with what you're doing. Then to the degree that you can do that, you find freedom. Because you're free of thoughts. That's the problem, is sitting and thinking about it. There's an old proverb, I don't know where this comes from, but it says, walls make our choices. Which, in Zen terms, has second meaning. When we have nowhere to run, when we're sitting, just to use the sitting condition, when we're sitting and facing the wall and there's nowhere to go, then what do? You don't sit and think about the time or anything else. You just get into your practice. They have a wonderful saying in Outward Bound, the program for teens, troubled youth, where they do outdoor excursions and camping. They say, if you can't get out of it, get into it. There. That's the essential point of that koan, Kyalkujo and a Fox. Or as Roshi Kapu used to say, not just trying always to do what you like, but liking what you have to do. That's the hardest thing in the world. That's the whole secret. If anyone could do that, we'd have a world full of happy people. And that's where the practice comes in. We can't just make up our minds, okay, from now on, I'm going to like whatever I have to do. Because the habit force of complaining, inwardly or outwardly, is so strong that we need a physical practice like sitting in order to silence those voices of griping and comparing and complaining. I'm going to skip actually like a page and a half here and just get to the end of the article. So the author says, so what about Hitler? The death of free will or its exposure as a convenient illusion, some worry, could wreak havoc on our sense of moral and legal responsibility. According to those who believe that free will and determinism are incompatible, it would mean that, he's quoting this Dr. Silberstein, people are no more responsible for their actions than asteroids or planets. Anything would go. Dr. Wegener of Harvard said, we worry that explaining evil condones it. We have to maintain our outrage at Hitler, but wouldn't it be nice to have a theory of evil in advance that could keep him from coming to power? I don't think a theory is going to. But here he says, he added, a system a bit more focused on helping people change rather than paying them back for what they've done might be a good thing. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's where meditation comes in. In an essay about free will in 1999, Dr. Libet wound up quoting the writer Isaac Bashevis Singer, who once said in an interview with the Paris Review, "The greatest gift which humanity has received is free choice. It is true that we are limited in our use of free choice, but the little free choice we have is such a great gift and is potentially worth so much that for this itself, life is worthwhile living." And then the author says, "I could skip the chocolate cake, but I really could, but why bother? Waiter!" Now, I just want to get in, before we end, a little more into this mind-blowing research showing that our conscious awareness of an impulse or an action follows the action itself, or it follows the movement, the initial registering of the action in the brain. I'm reading now from The User Illusion, amazing collection of material. The author, Danish science writer, Tor Nuretranders, I can't find his name here, Tor Nuretranders. "The point of Libet's delay is not that it is not people themselves who decide when to undertake an action. The point is that it is not people's consciousness that begins the process, but something else, non-conscious. It is still myself who disposes, but it is not my I that has the power to dispose." In other words, it's this mind with a capital M, our true self, we would say in Zen. He goes on, "This allows us to formulate a solution to the problem of free will. I possess free will, but it is not my I that possesses it. It is me." He uses the word me with a capital M in the way that we would use our larger mind, our mind with a capital M. So that's what I'm going to substitute here in this reading. "We must distinguish between the I and the true self, or self with a small s and self with a capital S. I am not identical with my true self. My true self is more than my I. It is my true self who decides when I do not. The I is the conscious player. The true self is the person in general. The I is not at the wheel in many situations. When urgency is required, for example, the I is in charge of lots and lots of situations where there is time for thought, but there is not always time. The term true self embraces the subject of all the bodily actions and mental processes that are not initiated or carried out by the I, the conscious I." He says here very provocatively, "Man is not primarily conscious. Man is primarily non-conscious." He quotes Joe Montana, the great, great, great quarterback, as saying that when he's playing, when he's out on the field, he's not conscious. He said that in an interview. And then here's where it gets very, very much relevant to practice. "The experience of free will is linked to situations where the," again, I'm substituting true self for his me, "where the true self dares to allow the I to make the decision. When more speed is required, the I and its free will are suspended. The true self simply reacts. The I experiences free will when the true self lets it." And he points out, as we have so often here, that this that we're always trying to get back to this transcendence of the ego, of the small I, through all the things that we may pursue most passionately: sports, dancing, playing music, games, intense conversation, sex, intoxication. In all of this, we are unconsciously, or maybe somewhat consciously, but mostly this is the longing to transcend the binding limitations of this ego self and find ourselves released into this greater mind, this greater reality of our true self. But how do we do that? How are we able to trust and come into accord with this deeper willing, the real willing of our? It's not by consciously. It's through practice, and practice is not only limited to Zen practice, but it's how does a dancer get beyond the eye that just gets in the way of the most complete functioning of her dancing? Through practice, just as we said earlier, through doing Zazen every day, it becomes natural. We're able to stop thinking about how we're sitting and what we're doing with our mind, and we just allow this mind to come forth. We get out of the way. He says, the role of the I in learning is precisely to force the non-conscious, the true self, to practice, rehearse, or just attend. The I is a kind of boss who tells the true self what it must practice. The I is the true self's secretary. So we start with the conscious intention. We have to have an intention in order to get anywhere in anything, whether it's Zen practice or any of these other things. But then we have to trust in something greater than this I. And in fact, Zen practice, because it's so fundamental, by doing this Zazen every day, we become better at all these other things, any of these other arts or cooking or anything else that we're doing. We are training ourselves to relax, open up, and let the wisdom of this true mind take its place in the driver's seat rather than vice versa. In terms of practice, and especially real intensive practice, such as in Sesshin, the whole point of all of our effort is to be able to surrender to that which is greater than our wants and desires. It takes tremendous effort. It does. But only in order to let go, to open up, and trust this greater mind. Well, there are masters from ancient China one at least I can remember, who said, just don't strive. It's very confusing. What he's saying, of course, is don't strive self-consciously with the notion of trying to get something for yourself. So how do we not do that? If we want something out of practice, and who doesn't? We want at least some relaxation, if nothing more. We want some greater concentration, and some people even consciously want to realize their true nature. So how do we get beyond that wanting and grasping? Well, by doing the sitting. That's how we dissolve the self-interested grasping for something, and that's how we get beyond the goal, which is just a concept in the mind. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.